the Mississippi Crop Situation Podcast.
Hey guys, we're coming back at you again with another episode of the Mississippi Crop Situation Podcast. I have Dr. Don Cook, Angus Catchott, and Jeff Gore, the trilogy of entomologists for the state of Mississippi, sitting in the office with me today. And we're going to talk about soybean loopers, something Don Cook knows a lot about. So Don, where are we at with loopers? I heard you getting a phone call a while ago about checking out a 20-acre field.
They're starting to show up. A lot of places I'm seeing them, it's just a few, but there are several fields that I've heard of and several I've seen where they're at or above threshold on numbers. Most of them have not reached the defoliation threshold, although I did see one that was treated yesterday or the day before.
Okay, guys, so I heard Don say two things there. He said threshold on numbers and defoliation threshold. So why don't y'all walk me through what is the difference and what triggers an application?
Well, some of our pests, depending on what crop and what pest we're talking about, we actually have numbers defoliation where you're actually counting the number of critters, and that will trigger an application, and some are plant-based. So with soybean loopers, for example, they eat foliage, so we have a threshold of 20% defoliation, and that's whole plant defoliation, not just the top or not just in the bottom, but we have essentially two thresholds for soybean loopers. If you use the sweep net, for example, it would be 19 per 25 sweeps during the reproductive stages, or you could use 20% defoliation.
So what do you find our consultants using them more often?
I would say probably, if you guys agree, I would say for sure probably the numbers threshold, because a lot of times folks, you know, if you hit some of these big numbers, you're going to get to that percent defoliation unless you're at a time of the year where potential disease may come in, and we'll probably hit on that a little while later too.
Yeah, and the thing about it is when they're first really starting to find those kind of numbers of larvae, the vast majority of them are probably third instar, about halfway through their development. And so at that point, they really haven't done a lot of defoliation yet. They're going to do most of their defoliation towards the end of their life cycle. And so they're eventually going to hit that defoliation threshold, and we know that based on a lot of the research we've done.
So you're trying to kill them before they get big and hungry?
Yeah, because, the last three or four days of their larval cycle, they eat like 90-something percent of what they would over that period. I think there's some guys are using a combination of both as well, as far as the numbers and the defoliation.
And they are. And like Don said, that's an important thing to remember, because something we don't talk about nearly as much, that threshold that we have of 19 per 25 sweeps, there's a little caveat in there that we don't never talk about, and that's half inch in size or greater. And it's because exactly what Don just said, caterpillars, and it really don't matter what you're talking about, whether it's loopers, bollworms, fall army worms, or whatever, all of them in about the last 3 days of their life cycle eat 90% of what they eat their whole time as a larvae.
So when we're talking about soybean loopers, you need to know how to count, measure, and identify damage.
Yeah, essentially, that's right.
All right, so it's a three-part thing. And you know, thinking about the soybean plant and what time of year it is, when do these loopers generally come in? Is there a common growth stage, or is it more when the time of the year when they happen?
It's more of a time of the year. Soybean looper is not a native insect. It does not overwinter here. It does not have an overwintering mechanism. Basically, it doesn't have a resting stage, so it has to be somewhere where there's year-round plant growth for the larvae to feed and develop on, and they migrate up here every year. And it varies anywhere from occasionally early to mid-July, we'll see a few, but usually, you know, late July through August is when we see them showing up.
So when we talk about that it's not crop growth stage dependent, if we have some late planted beans, double crop beans, they're obviously probably going to hit in the vegetative stage. If we're in our traditional early planting system, they're going to hit in some type of reproductive stage. I know y'all have done a lot of research, so where are we at with when is the most damage occurring, and based on defoliation, what can you tell us about estimates of yield damage based on these critters?
So we've actually had two different PhD students over the years that's came through And we've all been a part of this project. I mean, it was a killer project where we're out there hand defoliating plants, trying to get a better understanding of exactly what you're talking about. But what we've found out is during the reproductive stages, particularly R3 through the R5 stages, if you have substantial defoliation, and what I mean by substantial, we're trying to guard against these 50 or aboves, you can have catastrophic yield loss if you lose all your leaves. Now, again, we've talked about this on other podcasts. A threshold is set to where we're going to stop them at this point before they get at this point. So at 20% defoliation, I mean, we're not at danger of losing yield. We're trying to keep from getting to these high levels of defoliation.
An example of that yield loss is I had some trials last year that had a bunch of loopers in it for a period. I probably got up to between 80 and 95% defoliation, and I had 50, 60, 70 plus percent yield loss.
Wow. So one thing, I'll give you an example. And Lucas Owen, one of our former students that did this initial work, and he's got a chart that I usually put on Twitter and put out on different media posts probably every year when loopers start showing up, to give somebody sort of an idea of what you can expect at different growth stages of soybeans. But for example, if you lost 100% of your leaves, and that sounds far-fetched, but that can happen. If it starts raining, planes can't fly, and you have a lot of loopers in the field, you can lose all your leaves if you can't get to them to treat them. And at the R3 growth stage, we're essentially at that point, if you lost all of your leaves, you're looking at about an 85% yield loss. At the R5 growth stage, you're looking at somewhere of a 60-65% yield loss. Now, as you start moving later into the season, you start approaching R6. If you lost all of your leaves at R6, at that point, you're probably looking at somewhere of about a 25-30% yield loss. So as you approach these later stages, the amount of damage that they can cause you goes down drastically.
And that makes sense, because you get up to R6, you're almost to the full size of the seed there's mm-hmm. ever going to be. So,
when you're talking about that, and you talk about how that yield level declines, or the yield drop off declines later in the season, when do you stop scouting for these loopers?
So essentially the same as our traditional stink bug species at R6.5. And again, we identify this is important, and I went through this conversation a while ago with the consultant. But you got to be able to identify these growth stages. So when you get to R6, I mean, that's when we call in these beans squared off, not just touching. And I think we talked about this maybe last week on that podcast that we talked about. But when you get to R6, the beans are completely squared off. They filled that shell as much as they can fill it. About 7 to 10 days later, you're going to be at R6.5 when those beans have separated, that membrane has separated from the pod wall. At that point, those beans are not getting any more nutrition from them leaves. You could lose all of your leaves because they're not touching them and have zero yield loss.
Yeah, that's the point when they're going to start losing moisture.
Yes.
Start that maturing process.
Starting that dry down process, yeah. That's right.
So we're letting the air out of the balloon and that seed's starting to shrink into the form we all know when we harvest soybeans.
Yeah, but you got to make dang sure, though, that you're at R6.5. I mean, because, again, I did say you could lose up to 25% yield loss if you have a substantial defoliation event occur and you're not at that point.
And I think that's a conversation to have Trent on, and let's really key in on what is 6.5, because I think out in the real world it gets a little fuzzy at
times. Now I am talking about in the top four nodes of the plant. I mean, you got to make sure that right.
But I mean, basically you pull a pod and you shell it, if those seed are separate from that pod wall cleanly,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it's done. It's like Jeff said, it's
so you want to make sure that fleshy white membrane is loosely attached.
Yeah, exactly.
If it shells out clean and nothing, none of those, that membrane's not attached, that means it's fixing to start the maturity and dry down process. And if, like Angus says, if you knock every leaf off, then you've hurt nothing really.
And Jim Griffin showed some of this same work, but from a different angle at LSU when he was doing, looking at putting desiccants on beans. So, I mean, we talked about this a lot with red bandits last year and so forth when everybody was trying to go out as early as they could with desiccants, and Trent was heavily involved in that work as well.
Yeah, and I was lucky enough when that work started to be at LSU and was involved with some of that work too. But we've talked a lot about how to identify the bugs, how to manage for them as far as scouting. When we find these at a treatable threshold, how are we going to kill them?
Well, it's complicated. It's not complicated, but the options are not extremely wide because there's a lot of resistance with soybean loopers. And that's because, like Don said, they migrate north from southern latitudes, and time they get to us, they've already been treated by a lot of different chemicals at that point.
Yeah, I mean, by the time they get here, as Angus was saying, they're coming from South America, Puerto Rico, places like that where they've already been sprayed several times. So we're not creating the problem of resistance here. We're receiving the resistant populations from those southern latitudes. And the resistance that we're talking about is primarily with the diamides. And at this point, things like Prevothon and Besiege, at this point, you know, I don't think, and Don and Angus can comment on this, I don't think we've seen complete resistance yet. You can still get some control with those products, but it's not the kind of control that we used to get. And so probably our number one product right now for soybean looper control is going to be Intrepid Edge.
Yeah. Yes, the last couple of years, the first several years that the diamides were out, the performance was outstanding on bollworm. It was very impressive on loopers. The last couple of years, it's kind of like, well, this didn't look quite like it used to. So,
yeah, and one of the big differences that we've seen is we used to spray bollworms with Prevothon or Besiege, or even Belt a few years ago, and then we basically would never see a looper population develop after those sprays that went on at R4, R5, and then at R6, R7, a few weeks later, we wouldn't see those populations develop, but we're not seeing that anymore.
But you're not using Belt anymore.
No.
Well, but it is a diamide.
Yeah, I mean, it's just,
like Prevothon and Besiege, yeah. But loopers are hard to control. They're a game changer in a soybean system because of resistance. And it makes you, usually there's stink bugs in the field, and loopers cause a tank mix always because you got to do something special for loopers generally.
So what percent of acres in Mississippi do you think have a treatable looper population?
You talking about at this point right now? Or
yeah,
what
today.
I think it's pretty low right now.
Yeah, I mean, we're on the front edge of this right now. So today, you know, we're looking at mid-August, and I'd say it's probably a little early traditionally to have some of the numbers that we have, not unheard of by no means, but we got some pretty good numbers. But I've talked to quite a few people that this week that are having to make applications, and there's a lot more fields that I think by the end of next week will be treated, and in the next 3 weeks we'll have a lot of stuff as long as there's green leaves.
Unless we have some weather event, something like a cold front. Loopers, one being a tropical insect, or and getting this environment, they're subject to several diseases that can occur. I've had infestations where I either got trials out or fixed to put one out, and a little cold front comes through and it cools off for a couple of days, and there's any number of diseases that came in there and wiped them out within 2 to 3 days. I mean, from say 25, 30, even 40 per 25 sweeps to nothing.
I think this is a good point to kind of go back. And one thing that we missed on the threshold talk, and why we still have an insect count threshold, is that even if you're wanting to use a defoliation threshold, you still need to put a sweep net in that field, because you may go out to a field and be at 25-30% defoliation. A disease may have wiped out that population a day or two before you got there, and there not be any insects in the field. So it's important to use both those thresholds in that scenario.
And a good thing about, and this is my favorite part about a plant-based defoliation threshold, there's a lot of stuff out there eating on soybean leaves. So bean leaf beetles, for example, green clover worm, velvet bean caterpillar, grasshoppers, loopers, a bunch of stuff is out there feeding on soybeans at any given time. So what a plant-based threshold does, it's really a threshold that takes into account anything that feeds on foliage. So if I go out there, I may have a complex of soybean loopers and bean leaf beetles, and if I'm not running a sweep net, like Jeff said, I wouldn't choose the right chemistry that would take both of them out that are occurring together.
So you can't do one without the other. You got to have both parks to make the right recommendation to treat the field.
Well, you got to be in there looking.
Well, yeah, I think the bottom line is there's no absolute substitute for a sweep net in a soybean field.
That's right.
All right, so going back to you, Don, you said a cold front. You're talking about 70 degrees, 65 degrees. Where do you see, usually, think that magic number
usually
is?
Usually if it's in the 60s at night is when I've seen things kick off. The other part of that or condition, you know, if it's pretty high humidity, you're getting frequent showers, that can kick those off too, other diseases. The one, the cold front kicks can kick off as a virus, and it, I mean, it's devastating. But what we're seeing right now, we've got a student trying to work on loopers, and we've been making collections here, there, and yonder, is we're seeing a lot of fungal diseases because of humidity. Now, I saw fields that were close to or right at the defoliation threshold and above the number threshold, there's disease in those insects, but it's probably not going to kill them quick enough to prevent unacceptable level of damage.
Yeah, the other thing you have to have, other than just weather, is you have to have a big enough population,
yes,
for that disease to spread through the population.
So the tighter they are in there, the more disease will spread, yep, just like
with us. Well, it's kind of like the flu. I mean, if you're in a sparsely populated area, the flu doesn't spread very fast. You get in somewhere like New York City, it runs rampant.
That's true. Hey, I want to go.
New York City.
I love Don's analogies though, because they're always funny.
I was going to ask him where Yonder was.
Yonder's New York City, where they make bad salsa.
No, that's way over yonder.
That's way over yonder. One thing I want to go back to just a minute though is identification. And the reason I want to go back to identification of soybean loopers, and look, most of the people that are walking our fields, they know what they're doing, they're trained, they know that. But because loopers are resistant to so many chemistries, and you have to choose the right one for it to work, if you can't properly identify a looper, which I think for the most part everybody that's walking our fields can, but there are some young people now that are being hired that are helping look, but I want to talk about that just a minute. Loopers have two prolegs in the back, and they're tapered from the head to the rear end. So the rear end is fatter. But the two prolegs is the important thing. Loopers also start feeding in the bottom of the canopy and tend to move up, whereas bean leaf beetles tend to feed in the top generally. And that's important. But loopers are sluggish. A green clover worm or a velvet bean caterpillar, a green clover worm has three pair of prolegs, and they're very spastic. They jump around in your hand if you grab it out of your net, and so do velvet bean caterpillars, and they have four pair of prolegs. But the reason that's important is young green clover worms will loop on their sweep net rim like a soybean looper, and people don't see those prolegs. But the problem is they're so easy to control, a green clover worm or a velvet bean caterpillar, you don't want to spend the kind of money you would on a soybean looper. So identification is important.
And it, on the bigger ones, it's not that big a deal. The smaller ones, it's where it gets kind of sketchy on looking at that. We checked the trial this morning, and I'm squinting through my glasses. All right, is that two or three on one of these little bitty ones?
When are you not squinting through your glasses, Don?
He's squinting right now, if y'all can see.
He almost made me say something that I shouldn't have. But the other one that you'll see, and it's never any numbers, is a geometrid. It's what they call a true looper. It's got one pair of prolegs. I mean, we see them in bean fields all the time, never more than, you know, one or two here, there, and yonder. But that's about that and green clover worm is about the only thing you can confuse, other than cabbage looper, which is very almost impossible to distinguish between soybean looper.
Yeah. So, We talked about, and I don't mean to get off track, but we talked about control with and primarily with Intrepid Edge. But one thing I get a question about every year towards the end of the year is about straight Intrepid, which tends to be a little bit less expensive than Intrepid Edge. So what, Angus or Don, I mean, what are y'all's feelings on straight Intrepid?
it looked pretty good for bee last year. It's an insect growth regulator, and it impacts the molting process from one larval stage to the other. So those type of compounds tend to be slow, and it was slow, but it did work well.
Yeah, I still have no problem with straight Intrepid. The Intrepid Edge works a little faster because of the Spinetoram component in it. I mean, it's basically Intrepid plus Spinetoram, but it works a little faster. I mean, but I have no problem at all, use as long as we keep the rates right, using straight Intrepid. But again, that list is short. You got Intrepid. There's probably some Steward out there that works, but yeah, it works.
All right, guys. Well, we're getting a little long-winded. Do y'all got any parting shots y'all want to add to the soybean looper?
I guess one of my final parting shots is this is the week that they started showing up. Over the next 2 to 3 weeks, we're going to be seeing a whole lot more on a lot more acres.
The only other thing I would add is primarily to the Mississippi consultants. Like I said, we have a student working on loopers. If you got an infestation and if the airplane's not going to get there before we can, we'd love to make a collection.
Jeff, you got anything to add?
I can't follow that up.
Well, that's classic. So we appreciate y'all tuning in for another episode of the Mississippi Crop Situation entomology portion of the podcast. And when we figure out where Yonder is, we'll let all y'all know. So if y'all got any questions, give us a shout.
It's right next to Over Yonder.
The Mississippi Crop Situation podcast is produced by the Mississippi State University Extension Service.